In Iraq, a Western power invades and establishes a new political order, but that power is slow to create the new Iraqi government it promised. Meanwhile, Iraqis wage a low-level guerrilla war which threatens to spread, posing difficult choices for the Western power about how to quell the violence, which Iraqi factions it will work with, and how long it will remain there. A description of the U.S. in Iraq today? Perhaps, but it also illustrates the British experience in Iraq 80 years ago. NPR's Mike Schuster has this report.
During World War I, the territory that would become Iraq was part of the Ottoman Empire, an ally of Germany in its fight with Britain and France. British forces began a march from the Persian Gulf toward Baghdad in the fall of 1915. Initially, they met little resistance and quickly arrived within 25 miles of Baghdad. But a Turkish counterattack forced them to retreat to Al-Kut, where they suffered nearly a five-month siege. 13,000 British and colonial Indian troops surrendered in April 1916. By the end of that year, though, fresh reinforcements arrived and the march to Baghdad resumed, led by General Stanley Maude. This time, the British were successful, and they seized Baghdad in March 1917. General Maude issued a proclamation, reenacted here, that sounds very familiar today.
People of Baghdad, remember, for 26 generations you have suffered under strange tyrants who have endeavored to set one Arab house against another in order that they may profit by your dissensions. This policy is abhorrent to Great Britain and her allies, for there can be neither peace nor prosperity where there is enmity or misgovernment. Our armies do not come into your cities and lands as conquerors or enemies, but as liberators.
86 years later, a new invasion of Iraq would take place, with American leaders making a similar appeal to the people of Iraq. This is Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld on March 28th, a week into the Iraq War.
For our coalition of free people, we believe it is important not just to win, but to win justly. The power of our coalition derives not simply from the vast, overwhelming force at our disposal, but from the manner in which we employ that force. The Iraqi people will see how we employ our force and know that we are coming not to occupy their country, not to oppress them, but to liberate their country.
When World War I ended, the British occupied what they called Mesopotamia, the three Ottoman provinces that would make up modern-day Iraq, Mosul, Baghdad, and Basra. The British then embarked on the creation of a new government and a new state there. It was not an easy task. A debate emerged about whether to impose direct British colonial rule on the territories or set up a new Iraqi government. Some British leaders favored the quick establishment of Iraqi control, not unlike the goal President Bush outlined in remarks at the White House last week.
Having liberated Iraq as promised, we will help that country to found a just and representative government as promised. Our goal is a swift transition to Iraqi control of their own affairs. The people of Iraq will be secure, and the people of Iraq will run their own country.
The chaos of post-war Iraq has already caused the United States to postpone the first steps toward the formation of a new Iraqi government. In the chaos of the Middle East just after World War I, the British opted for direct rule in Mesopotamia, deciding that the Iraqis were not yet ready to run their own affairs. British historian Charles Tripp, author of A History of Iraq, says the United States in Iraq may be making some of the same mistakes that the British did.
I've heard American and indeed British officials now in Iraq talking about the Iraqis being too immature for self-government, not being ready to rule themselves. Now, that sounds exactly the same kind of language as the British were using in 1919, 1920, to the rage and outrage of many of the Iraqis, needless to say.
By 1920, the anger of Iraqis had turned to violence. A group of former Iraqi army officers in Mosul first conspired to attack the British. The revolt spread to Baghdad and central Iraq with widespread Sunni and Shia public demonstrations against British rule. Then an open rebellion in the Shia south, with hit-and-run guerrilla attacks on British troops. The 60,000 British forces in Iraq were spread too thin, but the tactics of the British were ruthless. They used ground troops to burn villages and launched bombing raids from the air. By the time they brought the Iraqi revolt to an end in early 1921, more than 500 of their own ranks had been killed and as many as 10,000 Iraqis. Historian Charles Tripp sees additional parallels in the current escalation of violence.
Military occupation, however well-intentioned it might be at the beginning, begins to take on very similar patterns. you create your own networks of informers, you burst into people's houses, you arrest the wrong people. You know, all sorts of things happen. Things go wrong. So you get the build-up of local resistance and local resentment, which, if joined up with others who think in a similar way, can be very, very troublesome on a national scale.
The 1920 Iraqi revolt forced Great Britain to abandon direct rule and fashion an administration with an Iraqi face. But the way the British carried out that policy would have far-reaching implications, according to Phoebe Marr, author of A Modern History of Iraq.
The British inevitably turned to the people who would cooperate with them, who were able to run the government in a sort of modern fashion. And who did that turn out to be? None other than the very same educated Sunnis who had dominated under the Ottomans.
The Ottoman rulers of Baghdad, who were Sunni Muslims, had favored the more educated Sunni Arabs of the region, who in turn were disenfranchised by British rule. But when, in the early 1920s, the British needed capable bureaucrats, military officers, and teachers, they enlisted the Sunnis. The British marginalized the South's Shia Muslims. The Sunnis would continue their domination of the country after independence, all the way down to the regime of Saddam Hussein. The troubles in Iraq also became a drain on the British treasury, and opposition in England grew, says historian Charles Tripp.
For many back home in Britain, the question of expense and loss of life were paramount. There was a campaign saying quit Mesopotamia, but they said, why are we there? We don't see any reason to be there. It's not important, and it's not part of our strategic or imperial interest.
But the Middle East and its oil reserves became increasingly important in Britain's imperial strategic considerations. The question of Iraqi democracy took a back seat to Britain's interests in the region. London granted independence to Iraq in 1932 after it put King Faisal on the throne. But Britain continued to influence Iraq until 1958, when nationalists overthrew the monarchy and ended London's strong role in Iraq's affairs. The United States could experience much the same thing, says Phoebe Marr.
This is a conundrum of every power that occupies. You can't have it both ways. We went in to remove a regime, understood. We would like to have democracy and a more open regime, but we also want a friendly regime. Those two things may not be synonymous.
The British never completely subdued Iraq and never fully subsumed it to their imperial interests. Now the United States faces its own goals in Iraq. The Bush administration intends to make Iraq a democracy, but it also has strategic goals in the Middle East: the war on terrorism, stability in the Persian Gulf, ending the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which a democratically elected government in Baghdad may or may not support. The British did not leave an encouraging historical example for the Americans on how to reconcile these goals. Mike Schuster, NPR News, Los Angeles.